it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the Everything Is Black and White podcast. It's time for the view from the opposition. And this week it comes from a familiar face and friend of the podcast, Tom Phillips, a Brighton fan and podcaster. Tom was on in the last episode when Newcastle faced Brighton down at the Amex. Tom, thank you very much for returning. How are you keeping?
Keeping, thanks. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to Saturday. Big game for Newcastle United. For Brighton, not so much. They've fallen away in the race for Europe. What does Saturday mean to Brighton?
I think it's just going to be nothing more than a training exercise, to be completely honest with you. We've had a lot of injury worries, injury problems, questions around squad depth, and kind of being bit of a case in point for Zerbi to the board in the fact that he wanted about six players in the summer, and again in January he didn't get them, and we're finding the reasons why, and that's mostly just down to the thrilling excitement of Europe, but also it does come with some cons, sadly, as you guys have experienced, but probably not as much as what we have.
Is there a slight disappointment that you're not going into this game, into the final week of the season, with something to play for, i.e. a chance to qualify for you for next season?
I think there was always that hunger after what was a sensational season for us last year. But when you just look at what we had in the summer, we lost McAllister, we lost Caicedo, who were pivotal in De Zerbi's style of play and exactly how he wanted the team to play. They were very much the center point of it all, so we had a completely new midfield coming in, and De Zerbi didn't really have that set, probably not until we probably could have got it sorted in October, but then injuries came, and then it was a bit of man management up until January, so that was a major setback. And I think if you asked a lot of Brighton fans at the end of last season, what would you take? And I think we'll say the same thing: decent run in Europe and top 10, which is more or less what we're getting. But I don't think a lot of Brighton fans will have asked for it to be in this kind of way.
Yeah, I've just looked at the league table there, and you guys are 11th. You know, just a couple of points, a point behind Bournemouth in 10th. And a couple of points behind West Ham. You say that it's going to be nothing more than a training exercise, but that doesn't mean, though, does it, that Brighton are just going to lie down and let Newcastle United walk all over them?
No, I think De Zerbi will definitely have a few words to say to his team. He wants his team to be motivated. He has said in recent weeks about whether or not he's got the motivation, or if his players have the motivation at the moment. He said after the Bournemouth defeat that his team, that the side just weren't motivated at all. They weren't really determined or push on or just execute the game plan in the way that he wanted to. That resulted in a huge win for us against Aston Villa. To be honest, I think everyone that went to that match wrote ourselves off very quickly. I think we were just there just to see what could be possibly. And we were quite surprised that we actually got snatched a win against Villa, who are going for Champions League football. Again, I think De Zerbi will be making sure that his team are up for the task. But personally for me, it's just a bit of like, right, we just got to make sure that we're going to be fighting for place for the squad next season.
Yeah, it got me by surprise when Brighton beat Aston Villa. I was not expecting it at all. It put to bed a six-game winless run. And when you look at Brighton's form, it has been absolutely dire. So they really needed that win against Aston Villa. But why has it gone so badly for them in recent weeks?
You just need to look at who's not in the squad. I think our team that is in the treatment room at the moment could easily be our best 11, arguably. We've had Matoma out for most of the season. We've had the internationals of the Africa Cup of Nations and the Asia Cup. So we had both our wingers out in Adingra and in Matoma. You would hope that Solly March will get involved, but he's been out with a knee injury since City away, way back at the start of the season. Then you've had Stupinan out. You've had Tarek Lamptey in and out of the treatment room. Adam Webster, Igor, Julio, Van Heck and Dunk have probably been the only two mainstayers. Then you've got the issue in goal. Jason Steele, who was superb for us last season, has been below par if you consider last season as average for him. But then you've got Verbruggen in and he's just not... He's young. He's a 21-year-old goalkeeper. He's got a bit of an error in him, but you can see why De Zerbi loves him. Then you look up top. Danny Welvick's been out. James Milner, I haven't even mentioned him. He's been out. He's out for the rest of the season. Lallana is out. Ansu Fati as well has been in and out of the squad. There's just not been a consistency in terms of the match day availability for Brighton, and every week it seems to be De Zerbi's kind of been like managing it. Players have been playing out of position. Brennan Notte, who's really a number 10, has been playing on the right wing. It doesn't work for him at all. He's just not got the strength or the pace out there on the right. He's 19 years old. He's technically a brilliant footballer, but he's not played his strengths. João Pedro's been moved on the wings up front in number 10. And because of that, because we don't have that service on the wings, Evan Ferguson's kind of fallen down a bit in his form as well. He's reliant heavily on dropping back and feeding the wingers out. Kind of like how Henri used to be for Arsenal, for those who don't know how Evan Ferguson plays. But he's so good. Well, case in point, for those who were actually there at the start of the season, he drops in, he finds the space, he's happy to take a long shot effort and it works wonders. If he doesn't get the shot, he will feed it out on the wing and then the wingers attack it into the box. That's typically what we do in the final third. But there's no wingers to attack. Ansu Fati, again, is just he's a confidence player and his confidence has been next to nothing this season, sadly. I would like to see him have another try for us next season if it comes to it. Now that Xavi's staying at Barcelona, personally, I can't see it. But there's a lot that needs to be addressed, and that's starting in the treatment room. And I think that's why we've actually signed a new club doctor as well.
I think Newcastle United fans listening or watching this podcast will feel some sympathy towards you, Tom, because Newcastle have been through the wars as well. And the times you could have named a starting 11 with the injuries that they've had. Thankfully, they are starting to get players back. Joe Linton, Nick Pope, Callum Wilson, Harvey Barnes, Miguel Almirón, all back and involved in the last game, either being on the bench or coming on the pitch or starting in some instances with Callum Wilson, who scored as well. So Newcastle are starting to get key players back, and that's why they're probably finishing the season stronger than most. I just want to read you a stat out, and you probably don't need me to read this stat out, but I'm going to read it out anyway, Tom.
I've got a feeling I know the one you're going to say.
Yeah, since beating Sheffield United 5-0 in February, Brighton have scored just 5 games in the past 10 Premier League games. It is their lowest return in a 10-game spell since 94 times in 10 games between February and April 2022. So in front of goal, and probably because of the injuries you've just mentioned, goals aren't exactly coming with ease.
No, they're certainly not. And again, it goes to my point. Conventionally, the front four would have been March, Matoma, Welbeck and Pedro. They will probably be our main four. And then you've got Evan Ferguson behind them. You've got Simon Adingra behind that. So on paper, we actually had a really good attacking threat. And De Zerbi is a big fan of goals coming in left, right and centre. I think that's why we seem to be such a threat all of a sudden when De Zerbi took over from Potter, because no one knew how to mark us. We were so good before, but that was because we were heavily reliant on one particular player in terms of getting the goals in. Murray during Chris Hughton days, and the Potter was more Trossard's. But now it's a case of everyone's contributing to the squad and everyone's really confident in front of goal. And I think that's why a lot of Brighton fans were really excited. It was a step up from the days of Graham Potter, who was fantastic for us, but it was just there was a lack of lack of urgency in that final third, which frustrated a lot of us. But now we're seeing that we have the capabilities, but we just don't have the fitness behind it. So I think that's where our new frustrations lie, is the fact that we see the squads and starting lineup and we just shake our heads and just be like, oh, if only Matoma's available, if only Adingra can play the way he wants to play, or Brennanote or João Pedro, who for me has been second best player of the season behind Pascal Gross, who to me, Pascal Gross is technically the best player I will ever witness in the Brighton shirt, and is probably one of the most underrated players in the Premier League as well, I personally think. But that's me looking through the blue and white tinted glasses for me. It's been frustrating in front of goal. It's not a surprise though, because again, our players are injured, our players are tired. We've had Europe with more or less the same squad. There's not been that much availability or fluidity in terms of resting players. It's been harsh for them. And for that, tiredness happens and we get found out.
Big fan of João Pedro, though. We know Newcastle, I really liked him. He's ended up at Brighton, scored 90 goals this season. I did say on yesterday's episode that he'd scored 20 goals. I'm not sure where I'd got that number from, but he hasn't scored 20 goals in all competitions. So I'm correcting myself now before someone reminds me in the comments. He scored 90 goals this season. He looks a real talent. And even for, what was it, 30 million, I think he cost Brighton?
Yes, I believe it's like 30, 35 million pounds is the region.
He looks like he's got the ability and talent to make that price tag look like a bargain, I think, within the next couple of years.
Oh, absolutely. And you look at how he was managed at the start of the season. He was playing the European matches before he was even getting a taste of starting in the Premier League. And I think that's kind of what De Zerbi really wanted to do to manage the season if we were all invincible and not prone to injury so much. And you just saw what he was in Europe. He stepped up to the mark. I mean, that away game in Marseille will always be iconic for so many of us, because João Pedro comes off the bench and scores a brace at the Velodrome and just made it look like his playground. For someone who's been in the Championship with Watford for a couple of seasons and just made it look oh so easy, he's someone that is not afraid. And I think that someone like him who's unhinged is frightening to see if you are the opposition. But when you've got him in your squad, you're that kind of fan where you're like, yeah, we're fine, because João Pedro is going to be the game changer for us. And like you say, I think he could be the next £100 million transfer that we're going to be seeing in the next couple of seasons. But he's so keen. He's already embedded himself as a Brighton fan, like the goal he scored against Palace and the celebration afterwards, just really get that strong connection in with the fans. That's the kind of character you love as a fan. And for someone like him with pace and flair as well, it's entertaining to see for any neutral.
And I think you just used the word connection there, and it was ironic because your connection dropped out. So I just had to make that joke. I made it in my head and I thought it's too funny not to say out loud. But we'll persevere on. We've spoken about Brighton's form being absolutely dire. I think it's the 17th in the form table over the last 10, and then I think it's 16th over the last 6. You know, it's not gone well away from home. It's not gone well either. When you look at Newcastle's form, Tom, you know, they're picking up points left, right and centre. I think they're third in the form table over the last few games, and at home they're an absolute force to be reckoned with. Do you look at how Newcastle United are finishing this season and think, okay, yeah, I'm a little bit worried? Let me just clarify the positions in the form table before we go on. Last 10 games, Newcastle are fourth in the form table, 19 points, 25 scored, 15 conceded. Brighton 17, so I was right with that one. 17 points, and that can't be right, sorry. Points. We're looking, no. 9 points out of the possible 30, conceding 17 and scoring only 5. It's not good, is it? Do you look at the Newcastle's form and think, yeah, I'm a little bit worried here?
Yeah, I think any Brighton fan that is actually going to be braving up the trip on Saturday is going to be thinking that as well as they walk up the steps at St James's Park. I think again, when you look at it on paper, it's just like, yeah, there's a clear winner in this on paper, and it's Newcastle. I think we're all just kind of thinking, look, so long as we could get some sort of a performance out of these guys and just take the positives out of it. I can't believe I'm actually saying that, because that's an iconic Graham Potter saying that, just taking the positives. I think we're just going to have to take it as it is, because St. James's Park is such a, it's an intimidating place to be. And as Newcastle are fighting for something, we're not. And the Newcastle fans will be thinking that we've got a great opportunity to take 3 points. We've got to make noise for this. And like you're saying, like all the players you've got coming back, either on the bench or starting or making an appearance from the bench, it's going to be worrying for us, because we just don't have that in our arsenal at the moment. So it'd be interesting to see how De Zerbi reacts to it. We've relied heavily on our youth towards the end of the season, so it'll be interesting to see how we are set up coming into this, knowing that we've got Chelsea midweek and United a week on Saturday.
Well, if you could lose to Newcastle on Saturday and then beat Chelsea and Manchester United to help us out for where we want to be, we'd be very grateful of that talk.
I'll take that.
In terms of how they're going to set up, because I spoke about this on the match preview yesterday with John Gibson. I look back to the game at St. James's Park last season, a game Newcastle needed to really win to help their fight for Champions League football. And I just remember being a tactical masterclass from Eddie Howe. And Brighton were going very strongly. They were sixth in the league. I think they were one of the informed teams at the time. And there was a real worry that Brighton would trip Newcastle up and Newcastle might even fall out of the top four. But Eddie Howe just did his homework. He prepped the players to within an inch of their life, and Brighton just had no answer to them. And if I'm not mistaken, I think a lot of people thought Brighton would win that game, or at least come into it slight favourites. This time around, how are Brighton going to set up? Because, like I said, a lot of the personnel are still the same. Okay, they've got injuries to comprehend with, but the manager's philosophy hasn't changed. So what are we expecting in terms of Brighton's approach to this game?
The same as what we have done in the last few weeks, in the fact that we'll probably be playing a conventional five at the back with the wing-backs pushing up and supporting the midfield, as they usually have done. Then you've got the two midfielders, most likely going to be Gilmore and Baliba, and then the rest will be whatever's available up top for us. So that will be probably, I would say, Welbeck, Buonanotte and Adingra will be the players that will probably start for us, just because, like you say, I think ideally we want to end the season on the high. And I think beating Chelsea, who have almost formed this little rivalry just because they've snatched about 15 people and their parents, kids and dog from under us for the past 2 years. So I think a lot of fans just have this bit of a grudge, a chip on their shoulder over Chelsea. So I think we want to prioritise that and then just finish the season on the high against Man United, who have got an FA Cup final to think about as well. They've got a poor run of form at the Amex, and I think De Zerbi will be looking to just end that season on the high. And I think it's going to be a case of damage limitations this weekend. So I think that's how it's going to be. It's going to be sort of like I wouldn't say concrete 5-2-3, but it'll be pretty fluid in the wing backs situation. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how Eddie Howe sets up, because he went 4-4-2 against Burnley, which is unheard of. It's unseen, never happens. And it worked really well. But I do think he might go back to a 4-3-3. That's what he played last time at St. James Park against Brighton. It worked so well. And you just make sure everyone knows what their position is. I mean, if Newcastle were to set up 4-3-3, I mean, is there one formation that you think benefits Brighton if Newcastle, say, set up in a 4-3-3 or 4-4-2?
I think it's more the case of who will play. That's kind of De Zerbi's approach. I wouldn't say the formation will be the slip up. It's who and how they're going to play. Our Achilles heel at the moment is that little gap, that almost little box between the centre-backs and our central midfielders. If you are able to dictate that, then you're laughing for the rest of the game. That's how Bournemouth managed to win so convincingly against us, because we just didn't seem to have an answer. No matter what we could try and do to fix it, we just couldn't, because Bournemouth had control of that area. And I think when you look at the midfield that Newcastle have and the attacking talent that Newcastle have as well, they're going to be looking to control that area, particularly on the attack, as well as just trying to stop Brighton to trying to control and dictate play from the back. So I think that's going to be the main area. I probably would say a 4-3-3 would work best in that situation if I was a Newcastle manager. But I think really any situation, either formation is going to pose an equal threat because of what you're able to have on your bench. I think that's the reason why you're probably going to go and get a result out of us.
Do you think Brighton will want to have more of the ball on Saturday, or will they give it to Newcastle and say, right, come on, let's see what you can do?
It's an interesting one, because we learned from Villa that if we had too much of the ball, they will just find that opportunity and take it from us. And they spanked us 6-1 at the start of the season. We changed and learned our lesson from that, and it was more of a case of game management, and we go and snatch a win at home. I would say probably give Newcastle more of the ball, but we've got to be able to shut shop and be keen at defence. The problem is that our defence just isn't there. Like, we're going to have a makeshift right wing back in either Veltman or Gross. Estupinan just hasn't been at the races at all. Igor Julio, again, has been in and out with injuries. It hasn't been the best debut season for him. Van Hek's out for the rest of the season. And I think personally, he's been probably better than Dunk this season, which I think for many Brighton fans will be a bit like, "Well, hang on here." But he's probably the most improved player in the Premier League in the last two seasons. And us missing him is going to be, it's easy to see why, because since he's gone, De Zerbi's gone from 4 at the back to 5 at the back. Just because of what he can do. He's as good as two centre-backs in De Zerbi's eyes. So, and then we've got the case of Adam Webster, who, sadly, he's been a bit of a Marmite player for Brighton fans. And he's just been loaned down the pecking order. He's got some very unfair stick on social media as well, but he seems to be growing into the role that he's in right now. Three centre-backs is definitely his forte. It's definitely where he works strongest. It's where he made a bit of a name for himself at Bristol City. So it's just, it all depends on the day, really.
And you mentioned Newcastle United and more concentrate on who plays rather than formations. I mean, is there a certain player that you're fearing more than anyone?
Almiron, Isak, I mean, Wilson.
Can I just stop you there? I can guarantee thousands of people who tune into this every week, not one person would have had at the top of their list Miguel Almiron. One person would have said that.
Really? The reason why I say that is he's going to be looking at what's in front of him. And if he's going to be on the left, he's got either Veltman, who is old.
Well, before you jump, because he has only just come back from injury. So the last time out, he was on the bench. Anthony Gordon, Jacob Murphy started on the flanks. Jacob Murphy had an absolute belter of a game, 2 assists, involved in the penalty. I think even though Almiron will be fit enough to start, I can't see him getting ahead of Jacob Murphy. I mean, stranger things have happened, but I think most people will be backing Murphy to keep that position on the right. But yeah, I could be wrong. And I tell you what, because I am the self-proclaimed founder and chair of the Miguel Almiron fan club, I'd like you to continue to go on and praise him anyway. So continue where you left off, please, Tom.
Absolutely. I just think that he's a player that has been a bit of a headache for us in the past. And I think when he comes and plays, he's not going to have Tariq Lamptey on this side. And Purvis is stupid. And like I said, he's been below par this season. So I think he'll be licking his lips and rubbing his hands when he just thinks, if I get 15, 20 minutes on the pitch, I'm going to be laughing here. And I think that's probably what's going to probably happen in my eyes. Like I say, Jacob Murphy, who has just been unreal in recent weeks, I think he can have a great opportunity. I think he could really frustrate either Veltman or Gross, just because if it's Gross, he's going to be pushing up more and supporting the attack. If it's Veltman, he's going to be He's going to be a bit more restrictive in terms of his freedom on that flank, but he's going to be quite easy to beat in my eyes. I feel a bit harsh on him because I love Joel Veltman. I think he's an absolute baller. But as a makeshift right wing back, definitely. But a right wing back is going to be even harder to do. So I think if he's got that opportunity and that gap, then Newcastle are going to be plain sailing. If they can exploit those spaces that the wing backs are going to provide, then again, you could be in for a real goal fest, especially when you've got the attacking talent of, you know, Alexander Isak or Callum Wilson up top. It's going to be a worry for us.
You mentioned there the right wing back. Well, he'll be going up against Anthony Gordon, who has got 10 goals and 10 assists this season. He'll likely start out on the left if it is 4-3-3, even if it's 4-4-2. Gordon will still be out on the flank. You mentioned Alexander Isak. I'm just going to continue reading out really positive stats from a Newcastle point of view. And if you want to cry in between them, then you do so. Alexander Isak is now in a select group of Newcastle United players because he scored against Burnley, and that took him to 20 Premier League goals for the season. In good company with Alan Shearer, Peter Beardsley, Les Fernand and Andy Cole. Anthony Gordon has been involved in more home goals than any other Newcastle player in the Premier League this season. 16, 9 goals, 7 assists. It is the most by a player at St James' Park in a single top-flight campaign since Alan Shearer, who got 15 goals and 3 assists. So the stats are good for Newcastle, especially at home. I think you already feel in that anyway, so I hope I haven't, made even worse.
The grin on your face. If you're listening to this on Spotify or whatever you're listening to on your listening devices and you're not having the chance to see it on video, just go back to this bit here because he's grinning like the Cheshire cat. And I'm grinning just because I'm either going to do that or I'm going to cry at this point, like you say.
Would you like another stat? Newcastle have scored in all 18 of their Premier League home games so far this season. They most recently scored in 100% of the home league games in a single campaign back in 1982-83 and have not done so in the top flight since 58-59. So there's another record due to be broken because I do think they'll get a goal or two against Brighton. But I've got one positive stat for you, Tom. Brighton are looking to complete the league double over Newcastle for the third time, previously doing so in 2020-21 and 78-79. So, you know, that's something to aim for.
Something to aim for. Don't think we've got that at the disposal. I'll take it. I'll take that stat.
I was speaking to my colleague in the match preview, and I was talking about, he was talking about De Zerbi, and from my view, I do think he's slightly overrated, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, tell me if I'm right. And I was wondering whether the links to the Liverpool job have maybe had any effect on this season. Has he had his head turned at any point by those rumours, do you think?
No, I don't. No. If you look in the summer, he was linked to the AC Milan job, which for boyhood AC Milan fan, you would think he would have just jumped on that opportunity, but he said no. And he knew why. And he just felt like it wasn't the right project. And he was actually quite free to admit that as well. And he was really invested in the project that Brighton have at the moment. And I think that's what he is. He can separate the manager from the fan, which I think shows that he's got a strong head on his shoulders. The Liverpool job, nothing concrete came from that. There was no real approach to Barber, to Bloom. Unlike what Chelsea did with Potter, it was clear as day that they wanted Potter. With Liverpool, they never really had the serious chats about, are we looking for someone in the Premier League? And who is it? I think it was a lot of a case of a lot of speculation. Quite rightly, De Zerbi plays exciting football. It's very similar. It's a good transition to what Klopp's been executing over at Anfield. I think he's got a great talented squad there that, again, De Zerbi could just showcase what he wants from the team. I mean, he's worked with Alexis McAllister, so he can instantly get one of the players that's actually grown to be one of the team leaders in the dressing room now. to win the squad over and say, we're winning trophies with this man. I promise you that. So I think everything on paper ticked for De Zerbi to replace him. But in terms of him being distracted, I think the only thing he was distracted by was how many players were required physio treatment or a visit to the club doctor. Again, I know I'm probably like a broken record when I talk about our injuries. I know Newcastle have had very similar situations, but I just think that's probably been the main thing for him that's really frustrated him. And he said in an interview recently how he wants to stay at the club. He wants to sign a new contract, but he wants a few guarantees. And I'm paraphrasing in that bit, of course, because Tony Bloom likes to have a certain way in the transfer window with his stats and with Star Lizard. I just think that Zerbi just wants a little bit more influence. And I think if we can give him that and probably the hypothetical blank checks that he wants as well, then he's going to be staying with us. Well, he'll sign a contract for 3 to 5 years. Whether he stays for those 3 to 5 years is going to remains to be seen. So I don't think the speculation got to him, because he really didn't care that much in the press conferences, or if he was questioned in live TV, he was just like, no, I'm focused on this project. I'm focused in Brighton. This is my club. This is my job. This is what I want to do. So I didn't really see much of it. I think if there was probably a bit more than just a speculation and an official approach, then yeah, definitely. I think he would have been, but I just couldn't see it, to be honest.
There we go. I'm disappointed somewhat as well that you haven't come on and taken the mick at the Dan Ashworth situation. I've been waiting for it.
But no, I tell you what, I'll silently enjoy it. But that's such an interesting one, isn't it? In the fact that he's willing to go on garden leave and leave it for Man United to deal with, and it's. I wouldn't say it's very similar to what happened with us, because he needs to go on garden leave because we didn't want you guys to have the advantage in the transfer window. Whereas I think he's been placed on garden leave because it was a case of, no, you're not going anywhere. Tough luck. So this is what we're going to do. So it'd be interesting to see how Newcastle respond to that, because I think I chatted to you in this podcast when I said, Dan Ashworth will be the big reason why you can get yourself and maintain yourself as a top four, top six club, because he'll get the recruitment, he'll get that DNA going in the same way that he has done for us. But I don't think he's had enough time to execute his influence. So what will happen next will be very interesting, and potentially you could find someone that's within the club, like we've done with Gordon Greer. But
well, they're about to appoint Dougie Friedman from Palace. I think he's the one that they've gone after, and it's actually not a case of wanting to keep Dan Ashworth. I think Newcastle, they're all right with letting him go. It's a case of not letting him go for the measly £2 million that Manchester United have reportedly offered. I think Newcastle are wanting a little bit more, and so they should, because he's signed a contract and he can't just go hot-footing it to a rival for pennies. But yeah, Dougie Friedman is the latest man reportedly leading the race for that job. I saw you grimace slightly there when I said that.
Well, I've got to slightly. Dougie Friedman brings back bad memories as a Brighton fan, but equally he's, he does come in with a great reputation. The fan in me, I can't praise anything about Palace, but you know, the journalist in me, you can't help but admire what Palace can do with their youth system. They've got a great history about it. They're enriched with it, and they pull out some absolute gems as well. Like, you know, we could talk about Yannick Bolasie and Wilfried Zaha as their wingers for so many years, but he's always been highly thought of. So, and he seems to be one that understands the English network. So I think that's something that Newcastle are keen to build on. And I do think that, particularly in the Northeast, there's something there that to unearth the gems and just really show that there is a clear path from youth to the first team. I think that's something now that we're seeing. And I think that's why Brighton is so attractive, because we can persuade players who could be going to Liverpool, i.e. Evan Ferguson, or Man United's Moises Caicedo, and say, well, look, we give you this development plan and you will be in the first team squad in 2 to 3 years. And 9 times out of 10, they do. So I think that's the attractiveness that they need. And I think someone like Dougie Freeman is the right man for the job.
Almost praise on a Crystal Palace legend there. Almost, not quite, almost. And I feel like I probably, did I ask you this on the last episode? And we are going off on a tangent here. But what is the rivalry between Palace and Brighton? Because I see it on social media and I just don't understand.
Right. So I would like to make this clear. That is nothing to do with the M23. The M23 starts at Crawley and ends in Colston. So no correlation to Palace over at Selhurst or Brighton, which play their games over at Falmer. So nothing to do with that. So it started in the 60s and 70s. Whenever we were going up, so were they. If we were fighting relegation, so were Palace. Previously, a bit of pub knowledge for Newcastle listeners. We used to be nicknamed the Dolphins. Palace have always been known as the Eagles. And I think some of you could probably see where I'm going with this. Few fans started taking the mickey out of the Eagles chant and responded with seagulls, 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 to which the directors just had their light bulb idea, we're going to rebrand, which clearly just got that little bit of a nudge there to go from, okay, we're competitive rivals to, oh, okay, there's something a little bit personal about this now. And then I think the thing that really kind of secured the rivalry was an FA Cup third replay. And that was over at Stamford Bridge between Brighton and Palace. Brighton had a manager called Adam Mullery. Palace had Terry Venables. Both players were in Tottenham's best team, most successful team that they always talk about. And Mullery was the favourite from the gaffer, whose name's gone past me. Venables never really liked it, and he's always held a grudge over it. And I think Mullery's always had that kind of like a mantra about him, the fact that he was the favourite. I think if I'm a qualified referee and I don't like to rant about referee performances, but if you watch the replay, which is available on YouTube, you would describe it as the most shambolic performance you ever see in the match official. And a lot of people would say that to this day. I think it was about 5 penalties, two for us, 3 for Palace. And it was just shambolic. At the end of the game, there is a great photo of Mullery giving it the two fingers during a police escort to the Palace fans. He then storms into the dressing room, grabs some change from one of the players' pockets, goes into the Palace dressing room, throws it down and said, congratulations, boys. By the way, you're not worth that, and slams the door shut. So there was a degree of pettiness and all that jazz to go with it. And it just solidified this unique rivalry that had nothing to do with location and just everything to do with just, it's just a pure competitive rivalry that has just blossom to what it is right now, which is hard to explain to someone like yourself, Andrew, or some of the Newcastle fans who still scratch their heads about it. But I just really want to say that Palace and Brighton fans will not agree on anything. And in fact, some will just go and play devil's advocate. But the one thing we will always unite in saying, it is not a derby and it's got nothing to do with the M23. We just really don't like each other.
There we go. You learn something new every day. I'm going to go away and now watch that FA Cup third round replay on YouTube just to see how bad the refereeing was.
Sorry, FA Cup third replay. The third replay. I think it was the fourth or fifth round.
Was it? Okay. At Stamford Bridge. I will find it. I was going to say we had a shocking referee against Burnley on Saturday, but it sounds like it was an even worse one in that clash in the FA Cup. I'm sorry to our listeners and viewers that we went off on a little avenue there, but it's always bugged me. So hopefully that has enlightened you as it has me. All that remains to be done, Tom, is to get your score prediction for Saturday. How is it going to go?
Well, look, Brighton have been almost like a shoo-in. If you're someone who likes to have a punt, then Brighton, both teams to score, seems to always return very well over the course of this season. And I think we're going to see the same again. But I don't think it's going to be happy days for the Albion fans who are going to be making that huge trip up to the Tyne River. So I think I'm gonna go with Newcastle 3-1 Brighton.
Interesting. I'm gonna go 4-1 Newcastle. It, as I said on the match preview, it feels strange sitting here confident and with an expectation that Newcastle United will do what they should do, I beat the team in front of them. Last week's episode, Burnley, I was scared. I was worried that Burnley would get the better of Newcastle, but it's just something about being at home, being at St James' Park, last home game of the season, European football within our grasp, in Newcastle's hands. They know what they've got to do. So I'm going to go for a 4-1 victory for Newcastle United. Tom, thank you once again for popping on to the podcast. It's much appreciated. We'll see you next season for the Brighton Newcastle clash, whenever that might be. I think the fixtures are out middle of June, so we'll find out then. But to you guys watching and listening, thank you as always. Hit subscribe, give the video a thumbs up if you're on the audio channel, leave us a rating and review, and head over to chroniclelive.co.uk for all the latest Newcastle United news. I'll see you guys next week.